We are Sarva. The future of education starts here.
Hey, welcome to this episode of Everyday Genius. I'm your host, Pete Craig. And today it's a great pleasure to welcome someone who is a teacher of the story theory. He's a corporate sage and a mentor. He's also the author of a book called Awakened Leadership and the creator of something called the Spiritual MBA. So please join me in welcoming Alan Shelton to the show. Hey, Alan.
Thank you. Thank you, Pete.
Cool. That's quite a it's quite a mouthful for people to kind of understand and grasp. But the thing that I really want to talk about today, because we've been looking at it ourselves, is this idea of story, and story theory. So perhaps to kick things off, just it might be useful for the audience just to understand what story theory is, where this comes from, and before we dive into the relevance and how we can use it.
Sure. The story theory, even though it is the cover or the name that was created so that it would live in the corporate world, it has spiritual roots. In the East, there is the notion that when one shows up as an individual, that there is an essence, if you will, called I am. That's what they label it as, I am. And in the West, what we actually utilize is a thing that I stole it from Joseph Campbell, and we call it original myth, which is in essence the same as that I am. So once you become, if you will, a separate operating entity, and I look at you and you look at me and I go, well, there's Pete and there's Alan. Pete wears glasses. I wear glasses sometimes, but the bottom line is that, you and I can figure out what the differences are, and those differences, then are utilized by our mind to go, there's the Pete story and there's the Alan story. And so the idea is that that story comes in a perfect package ready to go. That's always the essence. And the idea is that within, and you can tell this with your own children, if you've had children or anything along this line, is that for no reason whatsoever, those kids show up as clearly something different and unique to who they are. So, when Alan was a kid, he was active and loud and frenetic and all of those things. No surprise. That's what's in the package. And I'm assuming that Pete probably was, thoughtful and caring and generous and all the things I would say about you. So no surprise, that packaging was there in the very beginning. So all story theory is the idea that we spend most of our lives being conditioned away and taught to be something that is called authentic, but it's actually not who we are. It's an authentic model that we're told to be because people think that's what you need to be. So I was a businessman. I was created to work in the corporate world, which, and if you can imagine, I was working with a company called Pricewaterhouse, and you might have heard of them. They're a big British CPA firm. So take a kid from Southern California in the 60s who's effusive and all of the things that I am and put them in a stodgy 1800s version of a CPA firm out of London, England, you probably are going to see immediately there's not a great match there. And so I was taught to be like that. I was taught to be. So in those days, I had a three-piece suit. My hair was cut perfectly. There were things I was supposed to say and not supposed to say. And all of that packaging came with being a business professional. And that was what I was being taught to be. Well, of course, Alan, the Alan package, that's not how Alan operates. That's not, there's most of that isn't in there. That had to be learned behavior. And that squelches the authenticity out, which you can see that it would. So all story theory says is that in order to stand in one's rooted authenticity, if you can travel back and in some way, shape, or form find or embrace that original story now as an adult, right? And have that be the advisory experience. It's not, you don't even need to write it down because you know how it feels. It's who you are. Not a hard thing to find.
Yeah.
So you go find that, and then you ask yourself the question, what does that look like? What does that perfectly authentic package look like in the world that I now occupy? Mm-hmm. And we did that in the corporate world a lot. It started there because what we found out was that corporate executives in their functions were so much more highly effective when they were authentic than when they weren't.
Mm-hmm.
So it was really easy when you went to a company and they said, what's the payoff? And you said, your people are going to be more highly effective. They were like, okay, go do that.
Yeah.
And so that's the genesis and the, you know, the kind of the scientific, if you will, the roots of it all. And it has a lot of, I think the insights that we gained from it, were more stunning than what folks might believe. It was a, it was almost a renaissance in how it is you see that humanity operates is because every day we would work with this and we go, wow, you know, we can see the collision of what organizations and societies and assumptions that we all think are happening out there and how they were colliding with this emergence of our own authenticity. And we thought to ourselves, how's that possible? How is it that you live in a world where that's the collision, right? That I'm not sure if you had told me in the beginning that I would have believed that that difference was such a great, was such a, you know, it was such a big chasm, the difference between authenticity and the process packaged result that we all found ourselves in at one point in time. That was, I would have said, there's a little of that in there. It's way beyond that.
I mean, if you think about it, and I'm sure anyone listening who's of a certain age will, you will recognize that, you know, that difference, or at least be starting now to think about that difference. But when I think about that, I mean, I kind of like went into the world of management at 18 and at 18 years old, when everyone else is older than you, there's an expectation or you have a view of how you have to operate in order to gain those people's respect. So straight away, from that age forward, I was starting to put masks on, and I was starting to behave in a way that wasn't me, wasn't the authentic me, in order to fit into that role, that I wanted to be in. Yeah. And then that just, then the next time you change, you go to a different company that's got a different culture, then another mask goes on, or another layer goes on.
Yeah. Yeah.
And that happens. Yeah. Yeah, by the time you hit like 49, 50, you're looking back and you're thinking, wow, none of this, if you have that awakening, if you get to that point, you suddenly start realizing that none of this is me. And you start peeling those layers off and layers off and layers off. And you start realizing actually, there is this huge, as you say, this huge chasm between what's real and what's authentic, authentically authentic, if there is such a thing, and what you've become.
Yeah, I have a great story. You may have heard me tell this one before, but and I laugh at it now because it really illustrates exactly what you said. So at the age of 29, I've started this merger acquisition firm. It's on the West Coast, and it actually had about 100, 125 people in it. So we were, as a small independent firm, we were kind of the largest of that group, besides Pricewaterhouse and all those big boys. And so I was selected to be in a CEO group that met once a month, and these are CEOs from different, industries, and we would be each other's working board of directors.
Yeah.
Well, that was an awesome thing, but I'm 29, and I think the next person in there was at least 45, so I'm easily 16 years younger, and the average is probably about 55. So I'm sure that I'm 20, 25 years on average younger. So I'm young, wet behind the ears, no idea. And one day we were sitting in around the group and they were doing one of these exercises and they said, we're going to go around and we want you to say as a group, what's the most salient characteristic of each of the CEOs sitting at the table? Well, that was pretty easy. I mean, we had some big time CEOs in there, semiconductor companies, real estate investment companies in California and the West Coast and nationally, and medical companies. And so we're going around the table, and they get to me And you can see there's this very uncomfortable silence. Because what do you say about a 29-year-old guy who's, you know, trying to figure out where the water fountain is? You know, I mean, there's not a lot of seasoning, a lot of experience. Obviously has some clue going on because he's built this company. But other than that, what do you say? So finally, one of the fellows who became a very close friend of mine, he owned this big marketing firm. It'd take a marketer to do this one.
Yeah.
and he looks down and he says, I can tell you with a surety that Alan has the ability to make the obvious more so. And the whole room cracked up because it broke the uncomfortability, you know, it was like, yeah. And they actually had found something that I was pretty good at, which was I could make the obvious more so. And I laughed about that for years. I really, really did.
Yeah.
Then I started to, you know, write and do a lot of the work I'm doing now. And one day I'm driving down the road and all of a sudden the laughter just completely overtakes me. Because you know what? That is, believe it or not, one of the core characteristics of my personality is to look out there and go, well, that's what it is.
Yeah.
And in that kind of obvious is more so way. And I don't know why that it made me laugh so hard to see that they'd actually picked the authentic thing. It was all that was left, you know, because there wasn't anything else they could say about me. And it turns out that that's one of the main things that I'm right. So it's exactly as you say. Now over the years from there, I actually did what you said, which was I acquired and worked on developing other characteristics that weren't as easy to project. And I became a lot of what people wanted me to become until I worked myself into misery. But, you know, that's part of a lot of our stories, as you say. So making the obvious more so is, you know, is clearly one of the things you're going to get here.
Absolutely. And it does fit perfectly. You know,
it's a wonderful story to kind of, and everybody, the minute they hear that story, they go, oh yeah. Cause everybody can spot that in themselves.
Yeah.
You know, I mean, it's the idea that somehow we season ourselves to become more sophisticated, more, you know, intellectual, more systemic because we understand bits and pieces and put them together. And then you look at who you really are and likely none of that's in there.
Yeah.
You're probably a kid that liked to play in the sandbox. And, you know, when a butterfly came by, you were totally in awe, you know, which is an awesome thing to have in real life. Right. And it's a neat thing to breathe into companies and organizations. And it's this wonderfully authentic thing. It just doesn't live in that world of I've developed myself into this thing. And so that's where that split happens.
Mm, exactly. Exactly. So, and I know you've got some great examples of this. I just want to kind of look at, you know, what's the, you know, for anyone, you know, listening, what's the benefit of doing that? What's the benefit of going back to and discovering, you know, that original myth story? You know, within the corporate environment, you know, what was the payoff? Yeah, you know, I know you said that they would perform better, you know, but how did that play out? And I remember a story you told us, about the exercise you had them do to go away, and the guy with the, you know, his grandfather and the football.
Yeah, softball. Yeah, the soccer ball. Yeah. Americans call it a soccer ball. So excuse me, everybody. I know it's football. So I'll refer it to it as such. Let me just give you a little lead into that so that I can play back into it. So, as a human being, if you think about the first thing that you do and how you learn to even communicate as a human being, you are taught, you look out there and you have to teach a child, that's a chair, that's a whatever, right? And then we extract the pieces that we need from looking out there and we assemble them into a story. If you ask a four-year-old child a question, they are going to tell you a story.
Yeah.
So I think it's really difficult to get around the proposition that story is the natural expression of humans. And I would even go further and say it's your birthright.
Yeah.
Now, we've come up with the idea that in order to be more sophisticated, that we need theories and concepts and spreadsheets and all the rest. But what I noticed was that those particular renderings, first of all, were all story-based. Mm-hmm. And, you know, nothing wasn't story-based. They were just pieces that were story pieces rendered into something called a spreadsheet or a theory or a proposition or a value prop or whatever it was that you were talking about, or even mathematics, right? Mathematics ultimately is a story, because if it's not, you know, who cares?
Yeah.
So the reality ended up being that nothing that I saw in our world didn't tether itself back to that origin, if you will, which was a story. And it was really clear to me that that was our strongest suit. So how did we actually put that into play? So what we would do is say, well, the strongest story has to be your own original myth story. If you can find the story that reflects the who you are, that's the most possible thing. Mm-hmm. And then if you can find that story in whatever you're doing, you now have hooked your authentic original I am into the activity that you're playing within. So that was in a very basic way, that was all that we sought to do. And so we took the 50 top executives for a very large multinational company. Their headquarters internationally are in Lugano, Switzerland. And we took these 50 people and we said, and we worked with them, and we worked with them to where they could go and find within their past what they thought was their strongest original myth story. Now, for me, I tell a story with a skateboard. I'm a skateboarder, and so I have a skateboarding story. You've also heard I have a story about when I was a child and I won a red hatchet. That's another real clear story that is what you would call an original myth story. So it's not hard to find Alan in these stories. And the minute I think about Alan, I go back into it. It's easy to find. So yeah. If I said, Pete, tell me a Pete story, and go back to when, man, it was really Pete. It was all you got was Pete, tell me that story.
Yeah.
You can go back into your childhood and say, oh, well, there's this one time, Alan, and blah, blah, blah. And your eyes will light up and you'll have a smile on your face because you're really in the juice that makes Pete Pete. Yeah. And that's what's going on there. So we wanted to put them in that juice. And so we had them do that. And when I tell my skateboard story, I have a skateboard, you know, and here it is. And I take this and I go up front of the room, and this is signed by the founder of Vans, by the way, which is one of the brands I work with. And I tell that story, you know, and you can see the 11-year-old boy get all excited about skateboarding, you know, and all of that, because that's in the story. So we wanted everybody to do that. And I said, go find a prop if you have one, you know, and tell this story that is just who you are. And this one fellow, if I'm not mistaken, he was from Belgium and was from a little village. He wasn't from a big city. And so he literally goes back home from Lugano to Belgium, you know, to do the assignment, because we told him, go find your original myth story and then put it on a video for us. And so 50 people do this.
Yeah.
He goes back to his little village in Belgium. And the thing that really affected him the most was his grandfather, who had passed the love of football on to him. And so here they sit in this little village, and he does this video. He's got his grandfather on one side and a soccer ball in his arm on the other. And he proceeds to talk about his love for football and how his grandfather and his relationship lived in that love. And you could just see that this was really who this particular person was. So all of those came back, all of those 50 stories came back. And we then said, now what I'm teaching at the time, Pete, you're going to love this, because I was teaching them how to build and present a compelling business case. Hmm. That was what I was doing.
Yeah.
So I'm teaching them how to do that, which that means spreadsheets and numbers and PowerPoints. And you know what that looks like. Every decision in this company over $1 million required a case. And you would go in front of a group and you'd deliver your case, and you'd get it funded or not funded.
Yeah.
And in Europe, they found out that the people, they were underperforming the rest of the company, and they wanted them to be more compelling. That was the assignment. Can you go work with our executives and make them more compelling? So they indulged me and they let me go do this little story thing. I created the curriculum. They embraced it. We had them do that. And so then when we would build the cases, we were doing that in the room with all these executives. I could say, tell me a little bit of your original myth story. Great. Now tell me this proposition that you're standing in exactly the same energy. And they started to get it. They go, oh, well, if I was going to do this case out of that energy, here's what I would say. Great. Let's put that in the case.
Yeah.
And so we taught them to deliver those business cases as though it were their original myth story. Okay. What difference did it make? Well, in Europe at the time, they were getting approval on about 11% of their deals. And the company average was like 31%. And after we taught that in, they became the leaders in the company, and they were ringing in at about 67% or 2/3. So they went from 11 to 67. That's a 6 times increase. And they immediately came to me and said, what did you do? And I literally told them the story I just told you. And you know, they sat there and were like, that can't be what it is. I go, no, that's it. So the strength of that story, the strength of inhabiting your birthright and actually being it from a tangible standpoint, because stories look like they're things that live in our mind, but actually they were things that happened. There's an essence to it.
Yeah.
So if that essence can be where you stand in your own presence, then now you've got a really interesting proposition about how to be human.
Yeah. I was going to say, you know, it kind of reminds me when I work with companies, or when I was working with companies as a consultant, one of the things that I focused a lot on was either marketing or communication, and they're kind of one in the same. But what I always used to say, you know, and look at the messaging and look at the way they delivered, and it's very similar. But what I would talk about was actually, you know, coming out of the head and going into the heart and actually speaking and communicating from the heart, which essentially is the story myth, isn't it? It's that's where it sits. It sits in the heart because there's this emotion, this feeling that's attached to it. And so then, you know, if we want to go spiritual, you know, then there's a frequency that's emitted. Yeah, and people feel that, and they feel that before they hear the words. And because they're doing that, it takes their guard down, you know, and then they're more open and more empathetic to whatever it is that's been presented.
Right. And the way I'd say that, and that's perfectly placed, by the way, because I would say what you said is what I said. All I think I did was come up with a way.
Yeah.
That it was more palatable. Because if you go into the corporate world and say, I want your executive team to live in the heart, you kind of know what happens next. But if you tell them that you're going to take them back to an original myth story, et cetera, then they're like, oh, I get that. That I can get behind. But it's the same thing rendered in a different kind of look. But what's interesting is that if you ask somebody about what great leadership is in the corporate world, they will all agree that it has to do with presence.
Mm. Yeah.
Everybody will agree. I walk into the room, I feel the presence, that's a great leader. I mean, over and over and over again. Okay, great. So you readily admit that this tangible but intangible thing called presence, because we know what it is, but I have yet to find anybody that can describe it.
Yeah.
Right? Mm-hmm. So my goal, as I said, I want them to stand in a place that's tangible, but I don't care if you can describe it.
Yeah.
Because now I've got something with presence, and story holds that presence.
Yeah.
You know, your story holds that presence. So all I was trying to do was get back to that place in a way that they would let you go back to it, because I call all those other things faded versions.
Yeah.
And in fact, we would teach people that when they were tracking the room and they were working with a delivery, that if they felt the room start to go dead, they were like, you're presenting data, spreadsheets, pieces, parts, and that if they would immediately go back into the story, and I called it the story model ratio. Mm-hmm. And I would say, the minute you feel that, go tell some of your story.
Yeah.
And I said, you'll pump, the room will immediately become full of energy.
Yeah.
And then you can go back and talk about your pieces that go with the story, but they're just boring as hell. Sorry. They don't really spreadsheets don't carry a lot of presence. That's just what that is. So you have to continue. A great leader or a great corporate executive is always going to be bleeding in things that keep people with him and her. That's what they want to do. So the way to do that is to always emit presence.
Yes.
How do you emit presence? Well, your story carries it. You know your story carries it. Tell story. A lot of story. Your story, not someone else. And if someone else's story you love, that's yours as well. That's okay. That's fair game. Yeah. But make sure it's something that lives in your tangible presence. And that was what we would, that's what we would teach.
Yeah, absolutely. So I want to touch on something. It's related, but just to get your quiet view on that. And this is around the idea of why and the responses that people give to that. Yeah, so again, when I used to deliver and help companies understand how to connect at a deeper level, so especially when they're trying to raise money for property deals and things like that, you ask someone, on a surface level, you say to someone, why do you invest in property? The answer normally is very surface level, because I want to make money. You ask that question again and you get a slightly different response. You ask that question enough and you actually get back to the core reason. And the example I used to use was along the lines of, why do you do this? Because I want money. Why do you want money? Because I want to buy nice things. Why do you want to buy nice things? Because I didn't have nice things as a child. Why didn't you have nice things as a child? Because when I was a child, my parents divorced. We lived with the mother. We had to live in a council house. We didn't have much money, and so I couldn't have nice things. So why was that important? Because I didn't have nice things. I got picked on and bullied, and I had a very unhappy childhood. And I never want my children to feel the same. So you've gone from this kind of top level, I just want money, to now the real reason why that thing is so important. And that changes the dynamic of the conversation, because now all of a sudden someone understands, the driver for, whatever behavior it is or whatever it is that you're chasing. Yeah. And they can buy into that. So it's linked to the story again, but it's coming down to are those the same things?
They are. I would say that there's one place more than that, because I'm what you described me perfectly. I was poor being raised, and of course I could accomplish all of these things, and certainly the one looked like the antidote to the other. Mm-hmm. Right. But the original story actually lives before any of those events happened. Before I was poor, the Allen package was here. Mm-hmm. In honor of our earlier comment, I'll tell you a little story. I went to South America when I was 19 years old. So there was a great player there I got to see live named Pele. And so if you see that happen, of course, you now are addicted. And so you no longer are an American. You actually are part of the international community and you love football. So my favorite player, and of course, South American football was what I was always exposed to. So of course, those were the teams that I loved. And I guess it would come as no surprise that in today's world, Lionel Messi is my favorite. In fact, I think there's a Barca.
I had noticed that. I hadn't gone on.
you notice there's a Bayern up here too. That's my other team. So. Anyway, and just to make you happy, my favorite thing to watch is English Premier League.
Nice.
So, I actually have a team in that group, but it's a different story. But anyway, Lionel Messi is my favorite player. And so here's a little story about Lionel. He comes off the pitch one day, and they've just played Real, and it was a big game, and they've won. And they go into the locker room, and here come the reporters, and they say, Lionel, they said, when you were down in that corner, you basically, it looked like you probably needed to go deeper, to the baseline, but you actually turned in an unexpected way out. And when you did that, it gave you an open lane, and you were able to pop a pass and Suarez, you know, netted the goal. Why did you do that? And Messi would say, well, you know, down in that corner, there's that little bit of unevenness. And I, you know, I was being marked by so-and-so, and I knew that he would take an extra step. And I knew that the fellow behind him was out of position. And when you put all of that together, it gave me an opportunity to make a turn in exactly an unexpected way and find an open lane. And I was able to negotiate that open lane, and we scored the goal. And now the reporter's incredibly happy, right? Yeah. He's got all of the why.
Yeah.
The reporters leave the room, and of course, there's a young guy on the team that's befriended Messi, and he's learning everything he can. And he turns to Lionel and he goes, I heard you tell that whole story. He says, but is that really how it happened? He goes, oh, no, that's not how it happened at all. He says, I was out on the field, and he says, I was just being a soccer player. A football player. That was all I was doing. And what happened happened because I was just being that exact thing.
Yeah.
He said, but you know, when you talk to the press, they always have to know why, even when there isn't one. He said, and they wouldn't have been happy unless I gave them one. And he said, so me just being me wasn't the answer. It wasn't a good enough answer. I had to give them the why the me would act in the way they did, even knowing that there is no why. He said, so I give the reporters what it is they ask for. Mm. So in our human world, we think that those whys are incredibly important. And they can be to lead you back to this deep spot.
Yeah.
But there's one more place, which is how is Peter lived when Peter is just being Peter?
Mm.
You know, what's, you know, what does that look like? And there is no why to that.
Yeah.
There simply isn't a why. That would be like, why did Peter come packaged the way he's packaged? Why did Alan come packaged? Like who can answer that question? That one's way beyond that in terms of why. And we don't even know if there's a why involved in that, to be really honest. But nonetheless, that is where that original myth story actually steps over and around the very first why that you ever had to explain. Why did you do that, Alan? I mean, when you were a child, right? Why did you do that, Peter? I know you've heard that.
Yeah.
And you said, well, my mom isn't going to take any other answer but an answer, so I better come up with one.
Yeah.
And in that moment, you were introduced to what we call the causal world.
Yeah.
Now, does the causal world exist? Well, it may or may not, but you definitely know how to recite within that particular you know, construct. We all do. We all know how to answer why questions.
And I guess as well, that's the first moment as a child. You really experience story, or you verbalize story, should I say? That's the first point you're experiencing it anyway, because yeah, the story is already happening around you, and your parents are telling stories about you. So it's already forming. There's already people forming stories about you. But that's the first time, perhaps, that you verbalize a story is when you're asked that question.
Yeah, and what's interesting about that is that if the question weren't asked, you could tell the stories anyway. Most all of those stories don't require a why. They just don't. They're just, you know, it's what happened.
Yeah.
You know, Grandpa came, picked me up. We went to the ocean. We saw a dolphin. It was awesome. Well, why did Grandpa come pick you up? When you're a 3-year-old child, you don't know.
Yeah.
Like, so you make something up. You go, well, you know, it was 5 o'clock. He was off work, and that was the natural thing to do, or whatever it is that you say. Yeah. But the reality is that's the first little bit of detour on the conditioning of a child, is to get them to see that their stories are dependent, when in fact, we all know, think about creativity that's emergent. How could you say that creativity was dependent on anything? It emerges, it exudes.
Yeah.
So does our story. Our story lives in the world of that creative emergence, but not in the world of why. But we place it over there and then demand that people pretend that's true.
Mm.
And so that's that first little detour. So imagine a child that was taught that detour is just an exercise in engaging with humans. But the reality is that the emergence of who he is what can continue to be embraced, because we're encouraged to get rid of that as a child, right? In other words, it's as though it didn't exist. Hmm. So to me, the driver of education, if you know, the Dalai Lama comes out and says, we need to change how we educate. I take that to mean
that we need to
embrace what the obvious essence of who we are, or presence of who we are, as an absolute incontrovertible piece of any go forward in a child's education.
Yeah.
We don't want to give that up and detour them into the why world and leave them only there.
Yeah.
The why world is a way to engage. It's a beautiful way to engage, which your process was a beautiful way. Get back to something that was closer to the root than that's farther away.
Yeah.
And so those are all on the right path to get there. But education will be changed when that recognition is in place.
Yeah. You led that beautifully into the next question that I had, which was, a lot of this is kind of super relevant, that going back to the myth story is super relevant for adults. But if you flip it the other way, how do you stop future adults, so children as they become adults, needing to go back? How do you maintain that connection for them? How do we, as parents, as grandparents, as teachers, how do we maintain that for them so as they don't ever lose it and have to kind of go through the painful process that we've all gone through to get back to it?
So take my wonderful guy Joseph Campbell. Joseph Campbell, for those that don't know, was the man, at least in our current world, that decided that the stories of ancient cultures and even current cultures were the most important thing. It's called mythology. And he went to this little place called Sarah Lawrence College, which is in the middle of nowhere, I think in Pennsylvania, some state in the United States. And he got assigned as a PhD to the basement in some building out who knows where. And he was allowed to create this world of mythology. And so he basically, nested and settled on these stories. And he started to tell these stories and work with these stories. And pretty soon he became more and more important because people started to magnetize and flock to that because they knew intuitively that was a missing of some kind.
Yeah.
So he shifted, if you will, the face of modern education, because until he came along, you'd have to go find some, penguin book on ancient Greek mythology to even find the stories. And those stories had long disappeared from, certainly ancient Indian stories, both in East India and indigenous Indian, those had all disappeared. So really the way that I think that you embrace that is you see that the natural support of the story essence and flow is something that's always embraced in whatever is taught. So one of the things I'm known for, because there's a story in everything. And if you've ever seen a financial report issued by a large multinational, they issue a thing called an annual report. Mm-hmm. And in it are the financial statements. And if you've ever even stayed for 3 seconds on that page, it's what I would call chloroform in print.
Yeah.
It's pretty dreary stuff. Well, that's a story. And so I would be in groups and I would say, just give me your last financial report and give me 10 minutes and I'll tell you, I won't, just give me the numbers. I don't need anything else in the booklet. I'll tell you the story. And I would look at all those numbers and go, okay, so here's where they were last year. Here's where we are this year. Here's what's happened. So the story of this company is, and I would proceed to tell the story from those numbers, because those numbers were always tethered to and always emerged from the story.
Yeah.
Had to. Right. That was what they were there for.
Yeah.
And so the learning of that tethering and always seeing the story as the base driver of everything that emanates from it allows a child to in an authorized way, stay in story. They never have to worry about that. They're out of story. right? Yeah. In other words, they don't get taken into a spreadsheet. They go, oh, spreadsheets are different than stories. No, they're not. They're tethered. Einstein's theory of relativity, tethered. There's a story about how all the scientists figured out that there was something wrong with their theory of the moon. And because they knew that the rocks they got in the 60s were the same material as they had here on Earth. That shouldn't be true. They figured out that one side of the moon was thinner than the other side. That's something wrong there. They figured out that the moon orbited the close, in all the trillions and trillions of things they could find, no other moon orbited as close to any planet as ours did. Just didn't happen. So they knew something was up. So they had all of this data that they were collecting. Finally, these great scientists and physicists said, you know what we should do? We should hold a meeting. And they held it in Kona. They held it in Kona, Hawaii. And the reason they held it was so that they could create the story from all of this data that didn't mean anything unless they had a story to go with it. And so they did. And so the story emerged that one planet hit the Earth in a glancing blow, and what was left basically rotated and became what we now know as the moon. And now that's now the new accepted story of how the moon came to be. Mm-hmm. And without a story, how would we know that?
Yeah.
Right. It's in the story. All that data was meaningless unless you tethered it to a story and you and I could understand it. So I hear these scientists all the time, Peter, talk ad infinitum about the data they've collected. And I know that unless there's a story that you can relate it to, that nobody's ever going to in a million years understand or comprehend what that means. Hmm. You know that and I know that.
Yeah.
So unless you can reduce it to something comprehensible, does it really matter? And, you know, does it matter that that data even exists? Mm. Because it can't be cognized. If humans can't cognize what's coming at them, then what's data mean? And so that's a lot of what happens. So it's pretty easy if you think about it, if you constantly understand, hey, what's at the center of all of this is that story emergence. And if we can hold and respect that and actually create depth and rooting in that, that the kids are going to be fine. You and I both know this young boy he's got a financial head on him, right? But if he starts to believe that financial models somehow supersede or take the place of story, he's going to be lost in the world I live my whole life in, the financial world. And you're going to start to see, you know, it makes no sense unless the story that's with it gets told.
Yeah. Absolutely. So do we also need to like give them awareness of, So that's their own story, and that's kind of giving them permission to like keep their own story. But do we also need to teach them how to not interpret, but how to process the story that other people tell about them? Because it's very kind of easy to take on board, a story that someone else is telling about you or reflecting back to you. And then if enough people say that same thing, you almost take it on board as a part of you, one of your characteristics. So do we also need to show them in some way, how to discern between their original myth and the collect stories that are being told about them?
Yeah. And I think, now this gets into a little bit more of a spiritual conversation, so I won't bury us too deep into that. But the nature of assuming that we are all separate entities comes with an amazing way to look at the world, but it also comes with a downside of feeling separate. Mm-hmm. And in that felt separateness, we feel that we have to manage the stories that other people tell about us. And so we begin to seek to do that. I always tell the story about how you go to a restaurant and if you do what I do, which I love to eavesdrop. So you're going to listen to people talk to each other. That's one of the coolest ways to figure out what's going on. And you'll find a couple in the corner and they've been together for 50 years and here they sit. And they're trying to tell each other who they are. And I'm thinking to myself, after 50 years, they probably already know that. They don't, but yet, because of that sense of feeling separate, they think it's necessary to manage the other person's story. So just knowing that and seeing that, I think, is a great thing to understand, and that the neediness of being human lives in feeling you're separate, and that separateness drives us to act in certain ways. And that when you're in touch with your authentic story, you'll notice you don't feel that separateness. It's not felt, right? It's not part of what's going on. So you start to understand that, and I tell people this, I go, believe it or not, I would contest, or I would get behind saying living your authentic story and learning not to try to manage the stories that others have of you is far more effective in changing how other people hold you, as opposed to engaging and trying to affect their stories. Yeah. That would be that's how I would put it.
Yeah.
So now that said, you also see the kind of, I'm an independent person and I'm going to show them. Well, that also comes from that feeling of being separateness. Living your authentic story does not have to be a response to anyone either. It's just, it's that Lionel Messi story where I'm just playing, I'm out here, I'm a football player, I'm doing what I do.
Yeah.
Some people think highly of him, and other, right now, of course, he may be leaving Barcelona after 20 years. So there's a lot of controversy, but the reality is he's him. And he goes out and he plays, and all of what people think about him is kind of interesting, but how relevant is it?
Yeah.
Right. So when you start to see it that way, well, I think there's a learning in that. Mm-hmm. That's where the mentorship of wisdom of people who have seen the obvious, but more so, can actually play into saying, well, look at this, and how would you handle that? And that conversation, that mentoring conversation, I think must be recognized as a necessary to children's education.
Mm. Yeah.
When do they need a mentor? Well, mine was my grandfather. Mm. I mean, I often say he would tell me stories of Socrates, and I didn't know until I went to college that Socrates wasn't surrounded by a bunch of 5-year-old boys. Why was he surrounded by a bunch of 5-year-old boys? Because my grandfather turned that story into that because he was telling a 5-year-old boy that story. No harm, no foul. When I found out it was a bunch of, young philosophy guys in their 20s and 30s, that worked for me.
Yeah.
It didn't dim the story that my grandfather had told me, but he had managed that story so that a 5-year-old little boy could understand and admire and feel some resonance to this wonderful guy called Socrates.
Yeah.
And so that was my mentor taught me that he was in place and that happened early on. So how do you keep that mentorship in place over a period of time? That to me would be a feature of anything that we would want to teach from the child level forward. It's what we do.
Yeah.
Peter comes to me at age 50 and says, hey, Alan, da 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 da, and I go, you need a mentor, right? Let's get some mentorship in her, because it doesn't matter when. Let's get that lubrication happening.
Yeah.
Right.
Absolutely.
So it seems to be a feature no matter where you are on the arc. So to me, the earlier you can put it on the arc, the better you're going to be.
Yeah.
And then with a mentor in place, it's amazing how a child will say, well, I learned this from, and here's who's with me. They're not a vulnerable child as much anymore. They actually now have kind of a place that they can go, well, wait a minute. Here's what I'm learning. Is that not true? Is there something wrong with that? And then they've got the adults engaging in a conversation. That's a beautiful thing. Yeah.
Yeah. And I think, yeah, I mean, that's a beautiful place to kind of wrap things up, because I do think that's missing. Yeah, it's prevalent within the business world. I've had mentors, over the years, as I'm sure you have, but it's certainly something that's missing within the education system, because we have this kind of prescribed, teacher-led system that doesn't where the mentorship, because the dynamics of a mentorship relation are completely different to the dynamics of a teacher relationship. And I think I don't want to get into, you know, why education exists in the way it does. And what it's structured for. But yeah, I think that mentor relationship, because of the way it's almost kind of like on a level playing field, that allows your children that ability to, like you say, take on board knowledge, develop, and ask questions with confidence rather than developing this yes-no response.
Well, I think that, you know, and what you said about the business world is true, except for it's disappearing. Yeah. In my day, mentorship was much more prevalent than it is. And even, you know, I had some very well-known mentors because they would just look out there and go, oh, this person needs my help, and they would help. It didn't matter what their name was. And that was in the day. I came up in the 70s and 80s in terms of that. And so it was very prevalent then. But what has happened, Pete, to be really honest with you, is that we have come up with this new information world, and we see technology as an answer to everything.
Yes.
And so that started to take the place of true mentorship. And so to me, the human story is always going to cry out for tangibility. It's going to cry out. It's a hands-on experience. This is not you don't package it and deliver it. You have to actually deliver the mentorship behind it for it to actually have some movement and some possibility to it. Because my ability to do a narrated PowerPoint is as good as anyone else's, but that narrated PowerPoint does not do what can happen in the moment. It just doesn't, and I know it. And so I think the world, I actually look out there, and if you look at the world today, I see that that division and the contrast between positions that people are taking in the world as we understand it are so much more defined than they used to be. And I actually think that is completely connected to information, because information seeks to be identifiable from all else that it isn't.
Yeah.
In other words, I give you a piece of data, and all other data is excluded from this piece.
Yeah.
And so we learn to basically navigate and transact in a world where difference and stark difference is what's at the bottom of all of our activity. In mentorship, you start to learn the why there isn't a why, things that make, you know, the paradoxes, the things that make no sense, the movement of life itself.
Yeah.
And so those things are the balancing to knowledge and data and information. And I think what we've done is worked ourselves into a place where right now you're starting to see the resurgence of people going, wait a minute, there's something missing. They know there's something missing. What is it? And I think, so I look at Sarva and I say, I see Sarva as a natural emergence of understanding that there's a something missing. That would be how I would describe Sarva. I would say Sarva has seen that education has become more and more and more systemized, separate, defined, and delivers great information. But what it's not delivering is great leaders and great people.
Yeah.
And if you want to make that step, then you need, there's a missing. What's the missing? I told you what my version of it is. And there are lots of them, and it's and certainly I would never claim that mine or this one that I happen to propose is somehow whatever. I know that all of that will at some point in time be the counterweight or something that brings this back into balance.
Yeah.
And so that's how I see what we're up to when we start to talk about what should education look like and when should it start. And you and I would agree, the earlier the better.
Yeah.
So, absolutely.
Perfect. Well, that brings it to an absolutely perfect end. I want to thank you so much for sharing. Okay. It's been beautiful, and I'm sure there will be a lot of people that are listening that will benefit from simply understanding story. The importance of story. So yeah, thank you so much for that. It's been an absolute pleasure, and I look forward to speaking to you again.
Perfect. Thank you.
We are Sarva. The future of education starts here.